This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Those $600 checks are finally heading to people in need. We look at how the U.S. stimulus program stacks up.
Compared to the situation in Europe, the U.S. looks like an outlier.
We just haven't had that same type of federal response in the United States.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, majority Catholic Argentina legalizes elective abortion. Proponents of the new law celebrate their win across the country.
Argentina is a more just country and just society because of the pass of the law.
And in Canada, authorities say there was no foul play in the death of an activist. Friends of the woman argue otherwise.
We never imagined something could happen here like this.
And now people in Canada and across the globe want answers. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. It's good to have you with us today. Scientists in Britain say they're seeing some light at the end of this long, dark pandemic tunnel. The UK became the first country to grant emergency approval to a coronavirus vaccine developed by the University of Oxford and AstraZeneca. UK officials also decided to give as many people as possible a first dose of a vaccine instead of holding back supplies for quick second shots. That scheme will provide millions more people with at least partial protection from the virus. For more, we turn to Michael Head. He's a senior research fellow in global health at the University of Southampton. Michael, why is the UK's approval of the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine significant? Help us understand what this actually means.
This particular vaccine is hugely important in turning the tide on COVID-19. This vaccine from Oxford and AstraZeneca can be stored at refrigeration temperatures rather than the minus 70 degrees of Pfizer or even the minus 20 to 30 degrees of Moderna vaccine. So simply shifting it around the country and shifting it across to different parts of the world would be much, much easier. It could also be manufactured at larger scale so we can get more doses quickly.
Right. So this feels like good news, but by any measure, the AstraZeneca clinical trials have been rocky. They were halted for nearly 7 weeks after the illness of one participant in the trials, and they haven't been known for transparency and sharing data. So we know the planet desperately needs more and cheaper vaccines, but does the scientific community have enough data on this one?
Well, so we do indeed have enough data to be able to make the decision that this vaccine should be approved, as our regulators here have done. In terms of transparency, I don't know if there's a bit of a difference in how the vaccine is perceived in the United States compared to how it's perceived here in the UK. I think here in the UK, for example, the media coverage of when the vaccine trial over here was briefly paused due to potential adverse events, it was announced very quickly that the pause was due to an adverse event that was not related to the vaccination, and then the vaccine trial resumed quite quickly. There's been a decent amount of openness and transparency. There is a bit of confusion around the effectiveness of the vaccine, so there's a lot of subgroups within the trial in terms of when you get vaccinated with your second dose. There was the slightly curious sort of accidental half-dose, full-dose combo that's been investigated as well. So there are different kind of numbers depending on which bit of the trial you poke and prod and which bits you look at. But I think overall, the transparency and openness, which is hugely important, has certainly been quite good here in the UK.
I mean, the initial stumbles, though, from AstraZeneca, they did create some doubts in the public. Do you feel that there is a reputational problem at this point that will make it harder to persuade people to take this vaccine?
I think we've seen levels of vaccine hesitancy come down here in the UK over the last few weeks as the Pfizer vaccine has been rolled out and there's been TV coverage of people getting vaccinated. So some of our elderly populations, some of our healthcare workers, so some people that we sort of trust and respect getting vaccinated and making comments like, if I can do it, so can you. So I think that's helpful in terms of increasing the public acceptance.
I mean, one thing that was problematic initially with the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, the dosing protocol is not completely understood. Where are the gaps in our knowledge about it?
So I think there's been some clarification today with the announcement from the regulators and a couple of the expert advisory groups. So the initial accidental finding of the half-dose, full-dose that may have given greater levels of protection, it looks like the key factor was actually the amount of time between doses. So rather than giving dose two 21 days after dose one, if you give it a minimum of 21 days, so between 3 and 7 weeks, that actually improves the immune response and the level of effectiveness a bit more than the size of the dose. So it was a slightly sort of confounding variable that we saw with that half dose, full dose before. So we've seen a little bit of those sort of aspects cleared up. So yeah, there's a lot of subgroups within the data in terms of the age of the participants, how far apart the doses were. And the regulators here have seen enough in some of those subgroups to approve the vaccine on that basis.
What do we know about how effective this vaccine will be for older adults, Michael?
Well, we don't know a huge amount right now. The trials are still ongoing. There's enough data to approve it, but there will be more data coming, including in older populations. Another announcement today was that this vaccine could be recommended in pregnant and breastfeeding populations as well, so that women who are in that position should go and speak to their healthcare worker to see if the vaccine is right for them.
Michael Head is a senior research fellow in global health at the University of Southampton. Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed.
From an historic day in the UK to an historic day in Argentina. Cheers there from supporters of a bill legalizing abortion that was passed by Argentina's Congress early this morning. Thousands of supporters, as well as opponents of the bill, gathered at the Capitol building in Buenos Aires yesterday as the Senate debated. It legalizes elective abortion in the first 14 weeks of pregnancy. That is, despite a last-minute appeal from Pope Francis to leaders of the majority Catholic country. Pro-abortion rights groups are marking today as a long-awaited victory. Paula Garcia Rey is the deputy director of Amnesty International Argentina, which has pushed for legalized abortion. Paula joins us now from Buenos Aires. You were at the Capitol yesterday and this morning, Paula. What was the scene?
It was amazing, to be honest. It's been an inspiring moment for the women's movement in Argentina, but in the entire world. From Amnesty, we have been fighting and joining the fight of the campaign of legal abortion since 2007. Even in this momentum where the pandemic has really put enormous challenges to our countries, especially in Latin America, having this law means a recognition of our rights and women's rights in Argentina and the region. And so really we are thrilled to have been part of the historic momentum in our country. And we can say now that Argentina is a more just country and just society because of the pass of the law.
So previously in Argentina, abortion was only allowed in cases of rape and incest. Then last year, there was this terrible event. An 11-year-old Argentine girl was raped and forced to give birth because authorities refused to allow her to get an abortion. What did that event do to tip the scales in favor of legal access to abortion?
A lot. I think that putting faces and stories to numbers, it's been really relevant. Since the beginning of our democracy in 1983, more than 3,000 women died because of unsafe abortions. The Ministry of Health of Argentina has put in very clear words that unsafe abortion mortality have a response, and public policies means the legalization of abortion in Argentina. And it's been amazing, some senators that voted yesterday saying, I have my personal belief, I'm a religious person, but I'm acting here as a public officer, and my duty is to provide a response to those women who has been losing their life because of the legal framework in Argentina.
I mean, it's interesting to hear you say that because a majority of Argentines we know are Catholic and Catholic doctrine opposes abortion. When the news broke about the passage of the bill, a pro-life group called Unidad Pro Vida said on social media that, quote, abortion will not be law because the revolution of life begins now. I mean, the law is now on the side of abortion rights, but you see this as an ongoing fight?
I mean, definitely, they have been saying that they are going to go to trial and to justice in order to revoke the law. And Amnesty will be there also to fight in the justice power if they are trying to boycott this law. Of course, in Argentina, and I think in many other countries, one thing is the law and another thing is the implementation. And we have been having challenges in implementing the legal abortion that we have so far since 1921. And again, we are hoping as Amnesty and as a human rights movement, we are hoping to guarantee human rights for everyone in peace as a democratic society. When there was a debate we do respect personal belief, but now we have a national law, and we again will push for the implementation of this law.
Paula Garcia-Rey is the Deputy Director of Amnesty International Argentina. Paula, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
In September, the largest refugee camp in Europe went up in flames. Moria, on the Greek island of Lesbos, had a reputation as overcrowded and filthy. When it burned to the ground, more than 12,000 people suddenly found themselves without shelter. The Greek government eventually moved them to a new temporary camp on the island. The World's Lydia Emanuelidou in Greece has been speaking with people on the island about what life has been like since then. A warning before listening, parts of this story are disturbing.
The new migrant camp sits on top of a former military firing range right by the sea. From the very beginning, advocates and NGOs warned that this new location wasn't safe, that its proximity to the water would make winter unbearable. When harsh weather arrived, some of the predictions came true.
Hi, my name is Jarod, and I want to show some video about the situation.
This is a video a young asylum seeker sent me a few weeks ago after the first heavy rain of the season flooded the camp. He's 13 years old and from Afghanistan.
You know, there are lots of water that they are inside of the tents, and they can't do anything.
Migrants used buckets to scoop the water out of their tents, and outside, they dug trenches in the mud to redirect the streams away from their belongings.
The people are trying to put out the water and make it better, but they can't, unfortunately.
Javad has seen this happen over and over again when bad weather hits, including just this week. And when it does, people are defenseless. Many have nowhere to sleep until things dry up. Migrants inside the camp say conditions have been especially difficult and inhumane in the winter. It's always really windy. Electricity, running water, blankets are scarce.
This is a very tense and hard situation for the people inside the camp.
Nazanin Froghi is an asylum seeker on Lesbos. She's 27, from Afghanistan. Her family was recently moved to a different location on the island because they're farther along the asylum process. But she's experienced this camp firsthand and has many friends who are still there. She says one of the hardest things is that people aren't allowed to leave the camp like they were before, for example, to take classes offered by NGOs on the island. The new camp is completely fenced off, and police patrol the area 24/7.
And this feel that you are living in a prison, not in a normal place as a human being.
Greek authorities say movement restrictions have gotten tighter in recent weeks, partly because of the pandemic. The entire country is currently in lockdown. Olga Mutasidou is a clinical psychologist with the aid group International Rescue Committee. She's been working with migrants on the island for 2 years and says things took a turn for the worse when people were moved to the new camp.
I mean, people who were somehow being stabilized, they started having, again, crisis and psychotic episodes. We have a lot of suicide ideation and a lot of suicide attempts.
Many of the people Mutasidou works with have lived through war and violence. And the events of the last year, the pandemic, the fire, the relocation, the conditions at the new camp, she says all of that's re-traumatizing. People feel abandoned in a desperate situation that seems to have no end. Mutasidou says the mental health of children in the camp is also deteriorating.
People report that my kid cannot sleep in the new camp at all. It screams all night. They start having bizarre behavior, like starting to hit everybody or themselves. Children that used to be, normal kids, you know?
She says mental and physical health resources inside the camp are very limited, and that unless something changes, the situation will continue to get worse. For its part, the Greek government rejects criticism coming from advocates and migrants themselves. During a visit to the camp earlier this month, Greek migration minister Notis Mitarakis said the camp was in really good condition, that there was safety and order. He said it was inevitable that issues would come up, given how quickly the government had to cobble this camp together after the fire. Any lingering issues, he said, will be addressed next year, when the camp will be abandoned and the government will open another, more permanent site on the island. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou in Athens, Greece.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Unemployment benefits in limbo, stimulus funds uncertain, the $600 checks are finally heading to people's bank accounts. But for many people in the United States, it's been a messy road to pandemic relief. As The World's Ilana Gordon reports, the U.S. experience is pretty unusual compared to many other high-income countries.
Since the start of the pandemic, Werner Eichhorst has been tracking government policies across about a dozen higher-income countries in Europe, plus Canada and the U.S. It's been tricky.
Sometimes even the national experts that we have been talking to, they were not fully aware of some of the details and the complexities.
The pandemic has prompted countries to react fast. Eichhorst is an economist at the IZA Institute of Labor Economics in Bonn, Germany. He's been working with a group of researchers from different countries to figure out what exactly is going on. They've documented some really clear trends across Europe.
All countries have made their unemployment benefit systems more generous during the crisis in terms of levels or in terms of duration or in terms of the ease of getting access to those benefits.
This broadening of the social safety net in Europe is not lost on Reggie Williams, an international health researcher at the Commonwealth Fund in New York.
You have Spain experimenting with a form of universal basic income. In Italy, you see mortgage and rent suspensions. France, they've even taken the opportunity to bring it to healthcare and expanding some of their healthcare and health insurance benefits.
Countries are also building up something relatively new, partial unemployment benefits. Again, Eichhorst.
So that the employer does not have to dismiss the worker while he is not in a position to, let's say, pay for the full-time regular wage.
In other words, companies keep workers employed even when they have to scale back. And then when people's hours are reduced, the government kicks in with partial unemployment benefits to help make up for those lost wages.
These work-sharing arrangements have become so popular because they, of course, they can avoid or postpone unemployment.
You see countries like France, Germany, and the UK providing around 70 to 80% of lost wages for these workers that otherwise wouldn't be getting paid.
But Williams and Eichhorst both say one thing is even more clear. In comparison, the U.S. stands out like a sore thumb.
Compared to the situation in Europe, the U.S. looks like an outlier.
It's been an outlier from the beginning.
In terms of a massive increase in unemployment and a very minor role of these work-sharing arrangements.
When you look at some of the wraparound services and benefits, focusing on housing, food, access to other supports and services, we just haven't had that same type of federal response in the United States.
Williams says this means that overall, people in the U.S. are struggling more than people in Europe. He's been conducting international surveys and found something else that stands out. It's the added financial burden of healthcare in America, which can be dangerous.
It's really stunning. Over half of U.S. adults with lower incomes do not get the needed care because it's too costly. 50% of lower income adults skip doctor's visits, do not get recommended tests or treatment, do not seek follow-up care, do not get prescriptions filled. And you only see that at low percentages in other countries, at 12 or 15% in Germany, UK, Norway, or France.
Williams says as a result, income disparities are far greater in the US. They're becoming more pronounced now and are undermining efforts to control the pandemic. He says the latest round of COVID relief could be a positive step. But what gives him hope is what can be learned from these other countries. For The World, I'm Ilana Gordon.
Commotion outside a courthouse in Shanghai this week. A lawyer and citizen journalist was sentenced to 4 years in prison for picking quarrels and provoking trouble. Her sentence may have more to do with her work as a reporter than as a lawyer. The World's Rebecca Canther is in Shanghai. Rebecca, tell us about the citizen journalist, who she is, and why authorities went after her.
Well, Zhang Jian is 37 years old. She was a lawyer. But when China was first experiencing the coronavirus epidemic and Wuhan was about to go into lockdown, she took a train in and started talking to people. She went there because she wanted to know what was going on. She started visiting hospitals, talking to shopkeepers, and she started putting out videos online like this one.
各位朋友，大家好，我是张展。
She posted about 100 or so videos. They're not very high quality. They're just her pointing her phone and capturing what she saw around her.
what the government didn't like was that she was exposing some things that were going on that they did not want shared.
Right. And now she's accused of picking quarrels and provoking trouble. It's a charge which I gather is often used to arrest people who criticize the government in Beijing. So we've heard that Zhang Zhen has been on a hunger strike since June. What is her mental and physical condition at the moment? Do we know?
Yes, I spoke with one of her lawyers today. He asked me not to use his name because he's under a great deal of pressure right now himself. And he told me about her condition. So he's saying that during the trial, she was seated in a wheelchair. There's a restraining belt around her. He told me that she was quiet throughout the trial and refused to answer questions. The only thing that she would say was that she believed that the trial was unlawful and she wouldn't cooperate. She's been on a hunger strike since May, and she's been force-fed with a tube and physically restrained 24 hours a day to prevent her from taking the feeding tube out. And her lawyer says that on a previous visit, she was complaining of headaches, pain in her mouth because of the feeding tube.
So what did we learn from the trial about the case of Zhang Zhen?
Well, the lawyer told me that the trial was actually really short, just a few hours. And he said it wasn't a real trial. He said the prosecution didn't present any evidence, like her WeChat texts or her videos. Zhang Zhen is the first citizen journalist known to be put on trial for reporting on the coronavirus outbreak.
Right. And her case has attracted a lot of attention from foreign governments and media. What is the reaction in China to all of this focus on a citizen who was trying, it seems, to bear witness to the ravages of COVID-19 in Wuhan?
Well, you don't find very much information in the Chinese media about her or her case. The top hit when you search for her name is a video and an editorial by the editor-in-chief of the Global Times, which is a nationalist state-owned newspaper. And in it, he blames Western forces of corrupting and leading her astray. And I think that's a typical tactic of the Chinese government to blame foreign forces for one of their citizens, you know, going against script.
I mean, China seems to have done a pretty successful job of keeping virus numbers down. Why go after a citizen journalist in the middle of all this?
Well, I talked to Renee Xia. She's director of China Human Rights Defenders. And she says this is clearly about suppression of individual thought.
So if you criticize or you have an independent voice that's different from the voice of the government, from the policy, then that's not being tolerated.
So the lawyers will be filing an appeal, but Xia says that it's very rare for an appeal to overturn a verdict in such a politically sensitive case.
Very troubling story. The World's Rebecca Kanther updating us on the trial and sentencing of citizen journalist Zhang Zhen this week in Shanghai. Rebecca, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. An Israeli spy steps off a plane, then kisses the ground. And so ends a 35-year saga that soured relations between friendly nations.
Jonathan Pollard was flown to Israel on Sheldon Adelson's private jet. Adelson is a big supporter of President Trump and of Netanyahu.
More on that coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. 2020 saw a rise in danger for human rights activists in many countries across the globe. We don't usually think of Canada as one of those places, but the death of a Pakistani human rights activist in Toronto has raised an international outcry. Canadian authorities say there is no foul play suspected in the death of Karima Baloch, but friends believe she may be the latest in a string of activists targeted by Pakistan. The World's Rupa Shenoy reports.
From small groups in downtown Toronto and outside the Canadian Embassy in Washington, D.C., to huge marches in the streets of Karachi, Pakistan, people are calling for an investigation into the death of Karima Baloch. She was a 37-year-old Pakistani national living in Canada. On December 21st, she went for a walk alone along Toronto's lakefront and never came back. Her husband reported her missing, and a day later, police found her body in the water. Less than 24 hours after that, they concluded it was a, quote, non-criminal death with no foul play suspected. The Toronto Police Service declined to explain more.
We never imagined something could happen here like this.
Latif Johar Baluj was Karima's close friend. They met as activists in Pakistan and came to Canada together.
Police is saying she hurt herself, but I can't believe this. How you can conclude a case within hours after someone's dead, like a high-profile person?
Karima was a leader in the independence movement for Balochistan. That's Pakistan's southern region, home to the Baluj ethnic group. Many of its people use the last name Baluj. Aisha Jalal is a Tufts University history professor who studies Pakistan and is currently doing research in Lahore, Pakistan. She says Balochistan never wanted to be part of Pakistan, but its people didn't get a say in 1947 when the British negotiated a deal to split its former colony into India and Pakistan.
Balochistan has been a troubled part of Pakistan, but this is a country that has had a troubled relationship with democracy. The problem has been more concentrated in Balochistan, largely because it has been denied basic democratic rights.
The situation has grown even more fraught over the last few years because of a deal Pakistan has with China. A port in Balochistan called Gwadar Port is a crucial final link in a new network of highways and railways that would connect China to the Arabian Sea through Pakistan. Pakistan recently said it would erect a barbed wire fence around the 10-square-mile area that makes up Gwadar Port because there have been so many attacks by the independence movement.
When they started building up Gwadar, the Gwadar port, it was clear that there were lots of resources. There's a huge copper mine, there are lots of other untapped natural resources of Balochistan. These people felt that they were really being sidelined. And that actually has been a very major factor that has fueled the anger.
Human rights activists say Pakistan's military government has responded to critics, including people calling for Baluch independence, with brutal efficiency. Faiz Baluj is a UK coordinator for the group International Voice for Baluj Missing Persons. He says thousands have gone missing in recent years. Most of the time, they're simply forced into unmarked cars by men in plain clothes with guns. Faiz Baluj's group appealed to the United Nations, and it sent staffers to Pakistan to investigate.
But the problem is they were not free to go and meet people everywhere in Balochistan. They were confined in a hotel guarded by the army. So few people came and met them, but mostly people stayed away.
The resulting report did confirm disappearances, but Faiz says there's been no follow-up. One of those who disappeared in 2014 was the chair of a prominent activist group called the Baluch Student Organization. Karima Baluch took his place, becoming the first woman to lead the organization. Her stature grew as she toured the country, giving speeches and appearing on TV. In 2017, the BBC named her in its annual list of 100 inspirational and influential women. But soon, the Pakistani government charged her with terrorism. Karima fled to Canada.
It might seem my people are fighting for the independence of Balochistan, but in fact, we are fighting for an idea that all men or women have the right to be free.
This is a speech she gave in Toronto in August 2017 on Balochistan Independence Day.
Today, 70 years earlier, we achieved our independence from the British. We will achieve it again from Pakistan.
Karima's friend Latif Johar Baluj says Pakistani officials threatened to kill her friends and family if she didn't come back, and one of her uncles was killed. Then in May 2020, Karima's friend, Baluj journalist Sajid Hussein, was found dead in a river in Sweden, where he had been granted asylum. Latif Baluj says Karima told Canadian authorities about the threats she had received, but instead of helping, they questioned her like she was a potential terrorist.
This is unfortunate. They should be protecting us, but instead they were trying to know that maybe we are involved in something.
Latif and others are urging Canadian authorities to investigate Pakistan's possible involvement in Karima's death. He says it will be difficult to go on since Karima was the one who always convinced them that the fight for Baluch independence was worth it, despite the danger.
She was very courageous. She was very strong. She was like a bridge between us and our friends and families and everywhere. Now, myself or some other friends, we have to build that bridge, but we cannot replace her. So it would be a big responsibility.
Even though Latif says his family in Pakistan has already been threatened and attacked, he's preparing to lead the movement in Karima's absence. He says the fight for Balochistan will continue. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Today, Jonathan Pollard arrived in Israel more than 30 years after being convicted of spying for Israel. Pollard served 30 years in a U.S. prison and just ended his parole. He and his wife landed in Israel early this morning and were greeted by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. "You're home," Netanyahu said, and handed Pollard his Israeli ID card. I'm joined now by Noga Tarnopolsky. She's a reporter based in Israel. Noga, describe first of all the scene for us. It sounds like Benjamin Netanyahu gave Pollard a hero's welcome.
Well, it's been called a hero's welcome, but it's a strange hero's welcome because he had a one-man welcoming committee. Jonathan Pollard, a man convicted of espionage, was flown to Israel on Sheldon Adelson's private jet. Adelson is a big supporter of President Trump and of Netanyahu. He arrived at about dawn in Israel, and Prime Minister Netanyahu by himself was waiting for him with cameras. But his arrival has really not resonated among Israelis. It's not only not a headline by afternoon, it's just not even being mentioned in news bulletins.
Yeah, so a welcoming party of one, that would be the Prime Minister. What does that tell us about wider reaction to Pollard arriving in Israel?
It tells us that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is running for re-election again, and he's very concerned to keep hold of his fractured ultra-right-wing supporters who now have many parties to choose from. I think he hopes that getting Pollard so-called home will give him points with that voting group.
So just remind us, Noga, who is Jonathan Pollard? What's his story? How did he end up in a U.S. prison 30 years ago?
Jonathan Pollard was a U.S. Navy intel analyst working in Washington, D.C. in the mid-1980s when he started peddling his ability to get classified information out to a number of foreign embassies in D.C. Australia was one, South Africa was one. Israel is the embassy that fell for it. And what he offered Israel was what today we would call almost raw data. In other words, he would give piles and piles of documents unfiltered to an Israeli handler for which he got a ton of money. What happened is that he struck a plea deal with the prosecutors, and the judge in his case, this is 1987, the judge rejected the plea deal, cited a classified letter he had received by then Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger, the contents of which we don't know even today, and said that this guy was going to jail for life. And in the U.S. intel community, and I think in the Israeli intel community, the general feeling was that he deserved it. But more and more people in the Israeli right wing, and some not in the right wing, felt that it was an unfair sentence. And it's the longest prison sentence anybody has ever gotten for espionage for an allied nation in the States.
So U.S. and Israel, close allies, how did this spying affair affect the relationship between the two countries?
Very badly, very badly. And it's an interesting episode that we've almost forgotten. At the time that this happened, President Reagan was said to have said that he felt stabbed in the back. Israeli relations with the United States went through a period of at least a dozen years that were, I would say, pretty terrible, in which there was no trust on the American side and kind of groveling apology on the Israeli side.
So you mentioned, Noga, the upcoming election in Israel and how Pollard's arrival may be part of the prime minister's political gambit. I mean, how could Pollard being in Israel right now help Benjamin Netanyahu?
Well, Israel has an extremely fractured political arena. And what we're seeing in the last few weeks is the right wing coming apart and reforming itself. So there's been an exodus of pretty senior people from Netanyahu's party, the Likud. So what you have is basically a puzzle on the right wing. And Netanyahu wants to do everything possible to win even a tiny bit of those voters. And I think this is just the start of the campaign, and we're going to see any number of
gimmicks, campaign events, and this is one of them, and it's aimed at a very narrow demographic. I have to add something crucially important, which is that Netanyahu is on trial right now.
Mm-hmm.
His loss of support has come because of mismanagement of the corona crisis and the ensuing economic collapse. But what he hopes to do is to get enough votes to get a parliamentary majority. And he still dreams of being able to get retroactive legal immunity and halt his trial. That's part of why we see him engaged in this kind of act that seems to appeal to such few voters.
Noga Tarnopolsky, a reporter based in Israel, speaking with us about the case of spy Jonathan Pollard, who has just arrived in Israel, where he and his wife will now live. Noga, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
In the past few years, we've learned that tweets can have a huge impact out in the real world. We've seen that. So join our reporters and producers on Twitter. Bring your voice to the conversation about social media impact, and then ping us. We're at The World. Next Tuesday, two runoff elections in Georgia will determine whether Republicans or Democrats control the Senate. This has some left-leaning activists trying to galvanize Georgia's growing Latino community to support their candidates. From WABE in Atlanta, Martha Dalton reports on their outreach efforts.
Since the 1990s, Georgia's Latino community has grown steadily. That's when a lot of people moved here for jobs ahead of the 1996 Atlanta Olympics. But despite the growth, outreach to Latino voters has been sparse until now. This rally in December at a park near Atlanta was aimed at getting Latinos to vote. Local trap artist Cap G performed.
I got a question for the president.
Hey.
We've been working with the hell you been.
There were also speeches from actors like Eva Longoria and America Ferrera. The January 5th runoff elections will determine the balance of the Senate. Republican Senators David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler are defending their seats. John Ossoff is challenging Perdue. Raphael Warnock, who preaches at Martin Luther King Jr.'s former church, is taking on Loeffler. The races are tight. When Longoria took the stage, she repeated a phrase Georgians have heard over and over since the presidential election.
Georgia, all eyes are on you.
Then she said something Georgia voters haven't heard much.
And not only all eyes are on Georgia, all eyes are on the Latino vote in Georgia, and that is you. You will make the difference in this election.
That's the hope. One of the groups behind this campaign is called Mi Gente, a national immigrant rights group. The other organization is the Georgia Latino Alliance for Human Rights, or GLAR. There are more than 260,000 active Latino voters in Georgia, so Mi Gente and GLAR are trying to knock on every one of those doors before the runoffs. Tanya Unsueta, Mi Gente's political director, says it's actually hard to know more details about Georgia's Latino voters because there isn't much data.
And it's a result of the Democratic Party not paying attention to it, about resources not being in the Latino community.
So Unsueta says that groups like hers are building their own data as they knock on doors.
Hola, buenas tardes.
Hola, buenas
tardes. Aquí vive Mario Cervantes.
Kevin Wachin with the GLAR Action Network has been canvassing in Gwinnett, an Atlanta suburb with one of the largest Latino communities in Georgia. At this house, a woman answers, but Wachin is looking for the voter in the household, a young man named Mario. He finally comes to the door.
So we're passing out voter information for the election runoff.
Wachin talks about immigration reform. He says having a Democratic Senate will make it easier for President-elect Joe Biden to pass new immigration laws. Mario listens, nods, and agrees to vote for the Democrats. But Wachin's luck in other parts of the neighborhood is mixed. Some people aren't home or don't answer the door. Some just listen without commitment.
Hola, buenas tardes.
Tanya Unsueta with Mi Gente says canvassers like Wachin are most effective when they talk to people about issues that affect them personally. She says the data Mi Gente has collected in Georgia so far show issues like immigration, healthcare, and the economy are priorities for Latino voters here.
Talking about COVID and healthcare and immigration has been key in these conversations because when we've been able to move people, it's been around healthcare and immigration reform.
Just 10 years ago, Georgia passed some of the country's toughest laws against undocumented people. Now the tides are turning and Georgia's moving away from those tough policies. Adelina Nichols, a longtime immigrant rights advocate, says that kind of change can motivate voters.
It's not only that I have the power to get up to vote and I can vote with whoever I want, but also think, where are you coming from? Don't forget your roots. Don't forget your community. Because if you think of them, it will benefit all of us, not only as Latinos, but as society at large.
Nichols knows it'll be difficult for advocates like her to meet their goal of knocking on the doors of hundreds of thousands of Latino homes in Georgia by next Tuesday. But she says they're going to try. For The World, I'm Martha Dalton in Atlanta.
Here's a bleak fact from a bleak year. Deforestation in the Amazon rainforest is at its highest level in a decade. You don't give up on the lungs of the planet, though, and there are some people fighting hard to change that and offering a new vision for the Amazon. That's today as we take our weekly look at climate change solutions, The Big Fix.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
I'm joined by the founder of Amazon Watch, Atossa Soltani, from the Big Island of Hawaii. Atossa, you spent much of your life fighting for the people and animals of the Amazon, but in 2020, more deforestation, more fires, more destruction. What has this past year been like for you?
Well, the last 2 years, 2019 and 2020, have just been some of the worst deforestation rate we've seen in decades. And as you mentioned, this vital organ of planet Earth, the Amazon rainforest, it's basically reaching closer to a tipping point of no return, a tipping point of collapse when the hydrological system of the Amazon would start to unravel.
Well, you wrote an essay recently about how the pandemic can be a time to reimagine a different future for the world, and specifically for the Amazon. Explain what you mean. What does this pandemic moment actually afford us?
Well, I think the pandemic showed us that when it really matters, we can turn on a dime. We can shift our daily life. We can shut down the machinery of our economy in order to prioritize life. It showed us that we can take collective action literally overnight. We have the capacity to rise to the challenges that we face.
Given human patterns since basically forever, we know that after crisis often comes complacency. People forget what led to the crisis or they get distracted. What encourages you, Atossa, that when this pandemic is over, you think human behavior will be any different?
You know, I have my doubts. I have my moments of hope and moments of we're going to go back to business as usual. Those of us who are hearing the alarm bells or sounding the alarm bells have a responsibility to stay very much connected to this need for a whole societal transformation to a more sustainable world. We need to fight in the halls of power. We need to fight in Wall Street. We need to shift our investment patterns, our consumption patterns. We need to change the goal of the system.
Atossa, you now work on a project called the Amazon Sacred Headwaters Initiative. It's based in Ecuador and Peru. What's the vision for this project and how is it taking into account this pandemic pause and seeing a new way forward?
Well, the initiative really was born from the indigenous people's vision that they wanted to protect their territories, which they consider sacred. And this area of the Amazon is the size of the state of Oregon. It's teeming with life. In fact, it's registered some of the highest biodiversity anywhere in the Amazon basin. It's territories of over 30 indigenous nations. In this massive landscape, indigenous peoples have been fighting many battles for decades to stop the sprawling of oil and mining and roads and dams. And so similar to a Green New Deal, our initiative is carrying out this indigenous-led process of dreaming a new future. Basically, the premises of it is that this area should be and needs to be permanently protected from industrial-scale development. We are capturing the wisdom of indigenous peoples. And from that indigenous worldview, we are building an Amazon Green New Deal that basically sees a phasing out of oil and mining activities, sees governments committing to leaving unexplored fossil fuels and mineral reserves in the ground, calls on international corporations and international institutions, financial institutions, to forgive the national debt, public policies to monitor and control deforestation, support for bioeconomies of forests, forest products that bring livelihood and restoration, economies based on reforestation and restoration of damaged ecosystems, economies based on conservation and studying of the vast biodiversity of the Amazon. We want to support the sustainable solar canoes, for example, initiative that's already underway in the Amazon that's modeling a possibility of solar transportation.
Solar canoes.
Yeah, solar canoes. It's already being prototyped by the Achuar Nation with a project called Cara Solar, and it's having very promising results. Right now, our research teams are doing cost analysis of what it would cost to scale up all of these promising initiatives that we've seen all around the Amazon and how to bring them under the umbrella of a goal, the goal being to permanently protect 86 million acres of rainforest in the headwaters of the Amazon. We're under no pretenses that this is super ambitious and visionary and that it will take decades to realize.
It'll take decades to realize, you say, and you also said we're running out of time. How hopeful are you that you'll see this pivot in time for the Amazon and the people who live there to bounce back?
Well, you know, the interesting thing about the Sacred Headwaters Initiative is that unity of the indigenous peoples with their allies and gaining force. They are actually actively, even as I speak today, in active resistance to mining and oil. They're not just waiting on a beautiful, you know, vision for the future. They're actually taking action in the streets, in the courts, in the ballot boxes to demand a better future, to demand that the post-COVID economic recovery be one that's more harmonious with the forest.
Atossa Soltani is with the Amazon Sacred Headwaters Initiative. Her new essay about the future of the Amazon can be found in the book, The New Possible, Visions of Our World Beyond Crisis. It comes out next month. Atossa, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Marco.
If you're looking for new music to get your toe tapping or your head a-bobbing, then the producers and editors here at The World got you covered. We've collected our favorite global hits and sounds from 2020. Stream our Spotify playlist right now. It's on our website, theworld.org. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow on New Year's Eve.